Good evening. The title of my talk is Some Non-Meditational Practices That Bring Joy and Happiness. Several years back, there was a Thai monastic teacher who was here in America visiting Tan Jeff. Those of you who don't know who Tan Jeff is, he's an American a monastic who is the abbot of the Metta Monastery down in San Diego. And he said, talking about American Buddhist retreats, he says, you know, in America, on retreats you teach meditation, and then you teach loving kindness, and then you teach generosity, which is the exact opposite of what should be taught. If we look at the Eightfold Noble Path, which is the Buddha's prescription for relieving the cessation of complete suffering, there's eight parts to it. There is right view, right intention, right actions, right speech, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And the two we usually associate with meditation are right mindfulness and right concentration. So that's only two out of the eight. In America, in American Buddhism, there's great emphasis on meditation. And I have some opinions why that is so. First of all, when a number of teachers went to Asia to study Buddhism, they studied at meditation centers. And it was assumed that the other parts of the Eightfold Path were already perfected. Gil Fransdale tells a story of a woman he met who's Taiwanese and a very devout Buddhist. And he was talking to her and he asked her if she meditated. She says, no, she's not ready to meditate. She needs to perfect other things first. Also, here in America, a lot of people back in the 60s got involved in meditation from the drug movement, and they were looking for experiences and altered experiences. Matter of fact, Gil says a lot of teachers talk about how Americans, when they meditate, they are really into having experiences. And what are these experiences that people want? Well, people usually want some altered state of experience, because those can be fun. They want some insight into themselves, or they want peace and calm or concentration. Now, concentration and calmness, which comes with concentration, is interesting, because if you study what the Buddha said about concentration, he said if you really want to develop concentration, you should be happy. And but it's like a circular thing, because you're trying to get concentrated to be happy. And that's where these other practices come in. So what I'm going to talk about tonight is right action, right speech, right livelihood, generosity, and loving kindness. So the first one is right action. And usually what's thought of as right action is the precepts. And for lay people, there are five precepts. I'll say them quickly and then go into some talk about them. And that's not to kill, not to steal, not to abuse one's sexuality, not to lie, and no use of intoxicants. Now, these are not like commandments that if you disobey, a divine being will come and punish you. Actually, they're more like, they're actually called training precepts. And they're guidelines that if you break them, they will cause serious problems with your practice. And at retreats and also at other Buddhist ceremonies, people usually chant the precepts. And the chant goes, for the sake of my practice, I vow not to kill and I vow not to steal. And you're saying you're doing it for the sake of your practice. And it's like anything you endeavor, there's certain guidelines. If you are taking up, let's say, running, and you have to get up every morning to run, then you would vow to get some good sleep, because running would be very difficult if you're very tired. Now, if an Asian was giving this talk, they may talk about how if you disobey these precepts, you will be born into one of the hell realms, but we won't get into that. Starting off with the first precept, not to kill, some meditation teachers will talk about the precepts and how if you disobey them, when you go meditate, it'll be difficult to meditate, and you'll have a guilty mind. I'm not of that. I'm really more of a traditionalist. Let's take the extreme of killing, which is murder. The basic fact is if you murder somebody in this country, you will be hunted down by the law, which can be very stressful. And if you're caught, which you most probably will be, you will go to jail for a long time, which is also not pleasant. Also, in this state, you can actually be executed for certain murders, which is not pleasant. So this is really not good for your practice. It could really hinder you. But that's the extreme form of killing. The people practice it in various ways. There's also people who become vegetarians. And the basic gist of this precept is non-cruelty and non-harming. And so for us, killing is a real extreme, but what I think we all can relate to is the motivation of why one would want to harm, and that is anger. And I was reflecting on this the other day, because there is no precept, don't get angry. I mean, the Buddha talks a lot about getting angry, and one of the interesting things that's said in the sutras is getting angry is like passing a hot coal to somebody. Well, the person who receives the hot coal will get harmed, but so will you by passing the hot coal. And because of anger, a number of people can really get into trouble. I remember many years ago, when I was 25, I was subpoenaed to be on jury duty, and the rules for jury duty in Los Angeles are a little different than here. You serve for 10 days, and if no matter how many cases you're on, that's it. It's not like you serve one case, then you go home. I was actually on two cases. And what was interesting about the two cases is the two people who were on trial were both upper-middle-class people. And why they were on trial is basically because they could not control their anger, and it got them into serious problems. The second precept is not to steal. And then there's obvious the implications of stealing. But besides things like grand larceny, I mean, there's other subtle things to look at, like stealing things from the office. And some people make excuses for that, and they say, well, it's a big corporation, or cheating on taxes. And it's important the important thing with all these precepts is reflect on your intention. I mean, why are you doing it? Are you really doing to rob from the rich and give to the poor, or is it because you're going to get something for free? The third precept is not to abuse one's sexuality. Originally, this precept was basically not to commit adultery or have incest or have sexual relations with your servants. In the West, it's been defined as not to abuse your sexuality. Again, I take an extreme view on this in obeying this precept. A number of years back, I was visiting my in-laws, and they live in rural Ohio, and they're into guns and hunting. And my brother-in-law said to me, would you like to try to shoot a rifle? I go, sure. So I go out back, and I shot the rifle a couple of times, and then my wife said, let me try, and she grew up in the rural hills of West Virginia, and without using a scope, she hit the bullseye a number of times. And my brother-in-law took a picture of this, and every time I think about adultery, that picture goes through my mind, so I do not think about having adultery. But But seriously, I know a number of people who had very wonderful lives. They had a really nice spouse, children, nice home. And lust got the best of them, and it was all given up. Also, there's a number of Dharma centers in this country where teachers have broken this precept, and there's been a tremendous amount of suffering in this center. People actually leaving the practice. And so it can really cause a lot of harm, and it's important to reflect on that. I remember one time I was at a retreat, and Mary Orr, who's a teacher of spirit, I was talking about this precept, and she said, basically, we've all done silly things when it comes to sex, especially those who are dating. There can be a lot of greed, and so it's important to reflect on this when you're getting involved with people. The fourth precept is not to lie, and I can talk about this later. And the fifth is intoxicants. There's two interpretations of this. One interpretation is not to drink at all, and one is not to drink or drink to become intoxicated. This also refers to drugs and other mind-altering substances. And if you're doing a meditational practice, this will change and distort your practice while you're meditating. There's various other interpretations of this, but other things we do to cloud our mind, like watching television or getting obsessed with computer games or the internet. And this is for each person to look at and decide for themselves what's appropriate. As I said before, the important thing is the intention one has when one undertakes any of these acts. So this covers right action, and the next part of the Eightfold Path is right speech. And I think in Buddhism, this was broken out because it's such an important precept. A number of years back, Sylvia Boorstein, who's a teacher at Spirit Rock, gave a talk here, and she asked people, how many people have broken an arm or a leg within the last year and it's still bothering? A number of people raised their hands. And she asked, how many people broke one of their bones in the last 5 years and it's still bothering them? And a few. By the time she got to 10, it was definitely all over. Then she asked, how many people are in the last year or last week have been hurt by what somebody said to them? And a lot of people raised their hand. She went back to actually over 20 years that people were still raising their hand because somebody said something to them that really harmed them. The thing about speech and why it's so dangerous, it's in the Jewish religion, it's actually been compared to shooting an arrow. And the reason they say that, because once the arrow is released, there's nothing you can do. And people will go back and say, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't really mean it. But it'll always stick with you. The Buddhist guidelines for this precept and in speech is four things. First, is it truthful? So it's not lying, but also what are you saying? Is it truthful? The second, is it timely, that you say it at the right time? Somebody could be running off to do something and you want to tell them. The third, is it, help me out here, Andre. Huh? No, no, but the four things is truthful, useful,
kind.
What you're saying is kind. And what's the fourth one? Truthful, useful.
Kind and timely.
So those things. And I could talk for now. Actually, a couple of years ago, I did give a whole talk on this precept. The next part of the path is right livelihood. And originally, this was talked about for certain professions, it should be avoided.
for instance, arms dealing, dealing in intoxicants, dealing in slavery, in prostitution, or owning of prostitutes. I imagine if the Buddha was alive today, he'd expand this to a number of other professions. There was a Gil told an interesting story a while back that he was at a retreat. A lawyer came in to see him, and he said, "In my profession, I'm required to lie. Is that okay?" Which talks about our jobs. We spend a significant amount of time at our work. 8 hours, which is 1/3 of the day. And at our jobs, we do two things. Well, is we work to have shelter and to have food and medicine, things like that. But also, for many of us, especially here in the Valley, a lot of what we make a lot more than we really need. And so part of our reason for being at work is to acquire goods. And how much are we caught up in that? Also, there's the status of work and what will we do to get ahead. It's interesting in the also in the Jewish religion that there's a tale that when you die and you go before the heavenly court, the first question they'll ask you, they're not going to ask you, did you believe in God? Did you obey the commandments? The first question they'll ask you is, how did you deal in your business? Because what we do in our business has such an effect. Especially if you're like a supervisor, a manager, there's people you're taking care of, or if you own a business. So what I've just talked about is a lot of things not to do, and they're in the negative. Going back to the right action, I talked about not to kill, which is another interpretation is not to harm. But it generally has to do with cruelty. And the antidote for cruelty is loving kindness. And with stealing is really a form of greediness. And the antidote for greediness is generosity. So I'm going to talk about generosity now. The Buddha said, it's said in Buddhism that the path of Buddhism starts with generosity and ends with generosity. When lay people would come to the Buddha for teachings, the first things he'd teach them about was generosity. And in Asian countries, generosity is really taught at a young age. Young children are taught to feed the monks in the morning and to support the monasteries. I grew up in a Jewish background, and generosity was a very big part of our household and giving to charity. When people think of generosity, or as a Pali word is called dana, the first thing they think of is giving money. And that's one aspect of it, and I'll talk about that, but then I want to talk about other forms of generosity, which are just as important. Giving money, or giving any form of generosity, can bring a lot of joy. Before this talk, we were in the library over there, and we were seeing these emails from around the world. These talks are sent, put on our website and read by people all over the world, and people are writing in about the joy they're getting from hearing these talks. And that would not be possible if not for generosity, people giving money to help support that system. And it was really nice to start out, come here and sit to read that first, because it brought a lot of joy to my heart to see that. I can give many examples of giving money and the joy, but generosity is a practice, and it's just like a meditational practice. Some people have the attitude, well, I feel generous, so I'll give. And if people have that attitude with meditation, well, I feel like meditating, so I'll meditate today, or an exercise program, they really wouldn't get far. So one can always look for opportunities to be generous. And one should look for why one isn't generous. What are we holding on to? And that's why generosity is considered an antidote towards being greedy, because you're looking how you're holding on to things. And so one can explore that. When you want to give money to something, well, you know, why do you want to give a certain amount? Why not more or why not less? Another aspect of generosity, the way I see it, is we're really giving of our time. When we give money, we have to work to make money. We have to work to make money, and then we give the money away. But another thing is generous with our time. How many times do people want to talk to us, and we're too busy for them? A very touching story of this, Martin Buber was a very famous, was one of the most famous philosophers of the 20th century. He wrote this book called I and Thou, which is a classic. It had great influence on many theologians and actually psychotherapists. And what the I-Thou philosophy is, he says that basically we have two types of relationships to the world. We have the I-Thou relationship and the I-It relationship. In the I-It relationship, you objectify the being or person you're relating to. And that has its place. And the I-Thou, you're in relation with the other person, and that's the relationship you really want to have with God, is an I-Thou relationship. But the story is told about Martin Buber was, he was a scholar, and someone came to visit him. And he really wanted to get back to his work, and the person came in to him and asked him a number of questions. And he answered his questions, but he was quick, and he was not really engaged. And then he found out the person who came and visited him ended up committing suicide. And he said after that day, he understood that human affairs was much more important than scholarly affairs. And that's an extreme example, but as I said before, how many times do people come up to us and want our attention and we're too busy? And so doing that, paying attention to people and giving them your time, is a form of generosity. So I talked about giving your time to people and monetary. And there's also volunteers. Volunteering in our center is a form of generosity, giving one time. It's also important to be generous to oneself. People, especially in the West, have this idea of being saints and giving all your time, and that's very unhealthy way to be. Even with giving money, in the Jewish religion, I know in the Islam religion, you're required to give a certain amount of your money, but they don't want you to give all your money, because if you gave all your money, then you couldn't give any more. Also, the Buddha said people should enjoy their wealth as long as it's earned in an honest way and you're not greedy about it. But getting back to being generous to yourself, there's a story Jack Kornfield tells. Jack Kornfield is one of the most senior Vipassana teachers in America. And it was in the 70s, and he was really burnt out on giving retreats and seeing students. He was doing a lot of retreats. And then he heard that the Tibetan Lama was in town, very high Tibetan Lama, and he figured to go and see him. And he told him his dilemma. He was really burnt out. And the Lama said, I could help you. And he thought this was it. He's going to give him this really great mantra. And he said, well, you know what you need to do? You need to teach less retreats and go on more vacations. And, you know, it's interesting. We're always, when we think of generosity, we think of other people. It's also important to be generous to yourself. And like I said, there's a Western thing about that we need to be saints. And it's interesting, if you really look at the Western religions, they do not emphasize being saints. There's a saying by Rabbi Hillel, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? But he also balances the saying, if I am just for myself, what kind of person am I? The next thing I want to talk about is loving kindness. If everybody could just close their eyes for a second and think of somebody you really care about, especially a child, and think how you really want the best for them. You just want them to have a real happy life, and they feel a joy, and not have obstacles. Well, that feeling, if you were able to connect with that feeling, in loving kindness, what we're trying to do is to spread that feeling to everybody unconditionally. Now, traditionally, with loving kindness, one way of practicing it is we practice loving kindness on ourselves, and then we practice it on a preceptor or a loved one and friends, and then we do it on neutral people, and then we do it on people we have troubles with, and then we spread it out universally. Now, many people have problems with the first one, doing it on themselves, and some people have problems with that because some people really have severe psychological problems and about that, and I don't want to get into that because I'm really not a professional on that. But other people have difficulty, I can talk about difficulties I've had with it for a number of reasons. First, it's getting back to being the saint. They think I should help everybody else to be happy. And once again, the traditional religions and the Buddhist religion say differently. The Buddha said one can travel all over the world and not find one more deserving of love than oneself. Also, even in Western religion, in Christianity and in Judaism, one of the two greatest commandments is to love thy neighbor as thyself. If you don't love yourself, I pity your neighbor. So one starts out with doing loving kindness for oneself. And the important thing to realize is wishing oneself happiness. I think problems I've gotten in the past is, well, I really wasn't feeling happy because I wanted to be happy. And that's not what you're trying to do. You're not saying, I want to be happy. It's developing that wishing feeling on yourself. So when I have trouble starting off in loving kindness, I try to think of somebody that I really want to be happy. And then I can generate that feeling towards myself. And then from there, we go to somebody we feel close to and wishing them happiness. And then we go to neutral people. And for neutral people, I usually use people I see at cash registers who I don't even know, just wishing them happiness. And then we go to people we have difficulty with. Now, the important thing with people we have difficulty with is we're not condoning their actions. One I would like to talk about is doing it on political leaders. You can pick out the political leader you have difficulty with. But and people have troubles. We talked about this right after the election. I was not giving the talk, and I was saying I had no difficulty doing it for our political leaders. The thing to remember is we really want from our political leaders is we want them to change our behavior. I don't think we really want them to be unhappy. We want them to get ill or something like that. I mean, that could be really sadistic to want that. So to just send them or to wish that they be happy, that they be peaceful, and that could also send a light into them to be more open and to change their situations. And then that feeling is spread all over to everybody until it's universal. Now, a lot of these practices I talked about are really meant to bring delight and joy. And like taking generosity, I mean, it's okay to feel joy that you gave and that you did something. It's not really egotistical. If you notice, if you like watch the news, I know my wife and I sometimes watch the news and we'll see somebody who did something really nice. And it really gladdens the heart. And if it's if watching other people do good things gladdens the heart, why not what we do can bring us joy also? I mean, and you know when you're getting egotistical about it, there's a gladness and lightness to the heart when you do something good and generous. And then when you get into it, I'm so wonderful, then you know you've gone too far. But it's okay. And after a while, it'll just, the things you do in these practices will bring delight. And they're called either the purification of virtue or the cultivation of virtue. And Matthew Flickstein, who's a Vipassana teacher here in America, describes it as you could meditate and you could get some insights and some concentration, but if you really want to pursue the path, not fully developing your virtues is like having a heavy pack on your back. You can climb the mountain, but it'll be more difficult. And if you want to get to the pinnacle, which is, let's say, climbing Mount Everest, everything has to be carefully thought out. If you've seen documentaries and people who have climbed Mount Everest, I mean, the last part is you have to think at every single step. And if you have extra weight on you, you're not going to make it. That's why these practices are so important. They do set a foundation and do bring gladness. And I'll finish with this last story. A story is told of a monk who was practicing for many years, and he felt he really wasn't getting anywhere, and he was going to commit suicide. He was going to hang himself. And then he reflected, you know, for the last 20 years I've been a monk and I've obeyed all the precepts. And for a monk, that's a lot. That's 228 precepts. And that really gladdened his mind. And so much so that he was able to practice and develop deep states of concentration and insight and liberation. So thank you all for your attention, and I'm open for questions, and then if we have time, I have a cone for you, which I think you'll enjoy. So are there any questions? I guess you're really exciting for the cone. So I'm going to give you the cone, and we're going to discuss it, because it has to do with morality and a bunch of other stuff. Okay, here's the cone. A deeply enlightened old Zen woman allowed a young celibate monk to occupy a hut on her property and provided him with two meals a day and other necessities so that he could devote all his time to the study of Zazen. Zazen is meditation. When he had lived there for 3 years, she felt it was time to find out how far he had progressed in Zen. Her young and attractive granddaughter came to visit shortly afterwards, and she told the girl, "I need your help to test the monk living in the hut." "What can I do, Granny?" asked her granddaughter. "Please take his midday meal to him today. After you set it down, put your arms around him, smile sweetly, and ask, 'How does this make you feel?' Then come back and tell me exactly what he says or does." This is a real cone, by the way. The girl was at first reluctant. This was a long time ago, remember, but her grandmother persisted, so she did as instructed. The monk withdrew himself stiffly and replied, "I feel like a dead tree next to a cold rock in the middle of winter." Now comes the good part. No sooner had the girl reported the monk's response than her grandmother explained, "That worthless fellow, he hasn't learned a thing about Zen." She drove him from the hut and burned it down. So, let's discuss that. Anybody have any opinions on that?
Can you repeat the description, the dried up tree or whatever it was?
Let's see. "I feel like a dead tree next to a cold rock in the middle of winter." This is a true cone. This really is a cone. Anybody have comments on the cone?
What did the grandmother want inspiring him to say.
She was seeing if he learned Zen, how much he learned from his Zen. And actually, from the koan, you can tell that she thought he didn't learn a lot. Now, we talked about morality. Remember other talks about meditation and what you're supposed to do in meditation.
I wonder if the young monk might not have been testing his benefactor.
Yes?
It seems like if we're all together in this, then he should have felt love and kindness, that here is another human being that was warm. He shouldn't have felt like a dead tree, but she was a cold rock. She wasn't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what comes to my mind is the fact that he may have felt like a dead tree, but the very fact that he felt that she was a rock is basically saying he was not seeing her at all, he was unaware of who she was, or was denying to himself who she was. So he was, in a sense, the opposite of being mindful, in other words. Yeah. He wasn't mindful either to himself or to what's going on around him.
On the other hand, you have to look at her intention. She was simply obeying.
Can I ask a question? What's the purpose ultimately, you would achieve to practice meditation or Zen or Kung? So I'm just curious. From the story of Mamas, what are we trying to achieve?
I can read you some commentaries that they said in here about that. Let's see. And then Philip Capra. Philip Capra was one of the first Zen teachers. He went to Japan in the early 50s. And he passed away last year. Wrote The Three Pillars of Zen, which is considered a classic. So Kapler says, how would each of you have responded as a monk in that situation? And the first voice said, I'd say, I'm starved, and grab the food, not the girl. The second, not if I know you, you'd grab the girl and make passionate love to her. Third, I'd be suspicious that someone put her up to it, so I wouldn't touch her with a 10-foot pole. Fourth, if I were the monk, I'd say, what's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? Then Kapla Roshi responds, don't forget that the Mahayana teaches the middle way. If you grabbed the girl and made love to her, that would be one extreme. And if you acted disdainfully as the monk did, that would be the other. Fifth questioner, are you implying the middle way would be to put your arms around her lightly, hold her hand, or kiss her on the cheek? The Roshi said, would it be wise for a celibate monk to do even these things? And then a voice says, well, what's the correct answer? And the Roshi said, how can there be a single correct answer when the understanding of this problem may be demonstrated in more than one way? This koan, like every other koan, is thrusting truth at you. Truth cannot be taught, but must be caught. You may see more clearly what is involved. And then he goes into another story about this. Excuse me? Cheryl, why don't you give your interpretation of this?
In moderation, I sort of understand what you're trying to say about your question about
one way or the other way to go to the extreme.
Right, the
right way.
Well, I think it's what it's pointing to, that the situation is always different, and your ability to look at the thing from different angles. I think you can help you develop wisdom faculty in you. So you can develop the right approach for the specific situation. But it takes time and patience and cultivation of many faculties to get there. And that's, I think that's what you were trying to get to, too, wasn't it?
I didn't see anything about that. I just read.
can we come back to the situation? We can discuss how we could apply from the aspect of interesting for this situation.
I like what he said with those different people. Yeah, we're all saying because they were all kind of good possibilities, as I was saying. But you know, I think it's just opening your heart to the situation and not letting your your mind sort of run away with you or make up stories or be anything more than just what you are in that present moment with the young woman. You know, standing in front of you.
That
must possibly react
from his
point of view. Well, I think it's again, sort of pointing out to what his sort of understanding of Zen is about was he was projecting that on the situation when he was, in a sense, you know, maybe denying some deeper part of himself that was attracted to the young woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a natural part of it. It's just, you know, the woman grandmother was trying to say by the way the story ended, that's something she needs to look at more deeply. He's not there yet. He hasn't really seen the purpose is to look deeply within ourselves. And I guess is this making any sense to you?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Inez.
I think it's about greed and aversion are the two directions you can go in that situation, not necessarily just the extremes. Because if you're gonna, you know, grab her and have sex with her, you know, that's grasping in desire, or what he did, he just went to aversion, you know, I don't want this, you know, and contracted away from her. And so the middle path is a path of neither grasping or aversion. Is a path of opening, and you know, where the heart would have opened and there would have been a connection. And he, you know, the choice of what he actually did, whether he touched her or stayed celibate and didn't break a precept and touch, you know, that's all irrelevant. It's really what happens in the heart, whether there's a grasping or aversion.
Mm. How do you know what was in his heart? All we know that words he spoke that showed that he was not tempted. So that probably he was.
He
demonstrated his capacity not to be tempted.
Well, he sounded kind of cold and mean, you know.
As if there was a struggle.
Yeah, he sounded like he was pushing it away, like he was rejected or reactive. He sounded reactive in the story. You know, if he was just saying no to temptation, he would have said, "Oh, I appreciate your warmth, but no, thank you." You know, but he kind of exhibited it.
You see to fold all this together and see what it has to do with this talk. I said, "Is you know, a normal person would feel something, but." This is my interpretation, a wise and skillful thing you could have said. This is pleasant, but for the sake of my practice, I've taken a vow of celibacy. And it's because you're going for a higher good. And one thing with one way of looking at the Buddhist path is eradicating suffering. But another way of looking at it is each step on the path is replacing one happiness for a higher form of happiness. And one example I meant to give with generosity in the talk is James Berez, who's a teacher at Spirit Rock, tells a story that many years ago he was on a 3-month retreat at Barrie. And if anybody has sat a long retreat of a week or longer, one knows that anything that gives you a little pleasure is magnified tenfold. Because it is tedious sitting, and sometimes it's cold. It's like a hot shower or food. Having good food, that can be the big thing of the day, wondering what's going to be served for lunch. But someone left him a slice of cheesecake. And he decided to take the slice of cheesecake and slice it up into like 10 different slices, and he put it in front of the door of 10 other retreatants. And he says, you know, he could have eaten the cheesecake and enjoyed it, but, you know, to this day, the sharing gave him such enjoyment. He still thinks about it. Every time he thinks about it, it gladdens his mind. So in the Buddhist practice, we're replacing one form of happiness, let's see, having instant gratification with something that will bring us long-term joy. And in each stage of the path is like that. And if anybody wants an excellent book, it's called Visible Here and Now, The Buddha's Teachings and the Rewards of the Spiritual Practice. And this is actually about a sutra where the Buddha has, discussion with a king who asks him the virtues of the spiritual life. And he goes through, and actually the fourth step is what we talked about today, is the purification of virtue. And then one lets go of that and does a higher, another practice which brings even subtler forms of happiness. So I'd like to end tonight with loving kindness, and we'll go through it. So everybody can close their eyes and try to get comfortable. And one more thing is all the stuff, the generosity. After a while, it really does work. If anybody's seen the beginning of me at the sitting, how I was smiling as I was doing loving kindness. So start out and think of somebody who you really wish well for. And let those feelings well up. And you want them to be happy, to be safe, be at peace. And then send those feelings to yourself. May I be happy. May I be content. May I be peaceful. And wanting to share these joyful feelings with everyone in this room. May everyone in this room be happy. May they be content. May they be peaceful. And letting this happiness go out to this block, people at Hopkins Manor, the apartment buildings, people who live in the apartment buildings around here, may they all be happy in their lives and spreading out to the local neighborhood and to all of Redwood City. May everyone be happy. And all the people in the Bay Area, may they be happy, may they be at ease. And just spreading out over the whole country. May everyone in the country be happy. May those who are suffering now, may they be happy. And spreading out to the world, that all people in the world may be happy, that those who are having difficulties, may they overcome their difficulties. And radiating out, may all beings everywhere be happy and at ease.
So thank you all for coming.